From the Autoline Studios, here is your host, John McElroy.
I want to thank you all for joining us on Autoline this week, where the discussion is going to be about some of the early formative years of the UAW. And that's because we've got a great book here called Built in Detroit, a story of the UAW, a company, and a gangster. And we've got the author of that book with us today, Bob Morris, a son of a very leading UAW executive. And Bob, I want to thank you for joining us here on Autoline this week.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Also joining us today are Mark Phelan from the Detroit Free Press and Henry Payne from the Detroit News. And great having the both of you here, too.
Thank you, John.
You know, Bob, I think everybody knows a little bit about the early years of the UAW, the sit-down strike in Flint against General Motors, the battle of the overpass with the Ford Motor Company.
Yep, yep.
But what your book really shows is that the true formative years of the UAW were at the Briggs Manufacturing Company, something I really knew nothing about.
Well, it was Briggs, but there was other plants around the city, some of the big three, and Hudson and Packard and the old companies. But Briggs was an incredibly important plant because they built bodies for Ford, Chrysler, Dodge, Packard, Hudson. You had a body by Fisher for GM, and then Briggs. And so if something happened at Briggs, if there was a strike, there, they stopped auto production throughout the
So it gave them great bargaining power.
Incredible. Caused problems, too, because there'd be a lot of wildcat strikes, and that created other problems in the book.
And Briggs had a level of hostility to unions that makes the stuff that we see in the news today, you know, look like child's play.
Without a doubt. And, of course, the book, that's where the gangster comes in the book. Ultimately, Briggs fought. Much like Henry Ford did, the organization by the UAW, when it was organized, they dragged their feet on contracts. People would get fired for a lot of different reasons. At the bottom line, it was to figure out how to weaken the union, weaken strong leadership. And so, it was a very ugly, and it grew into a very ugly situation.
And your father, Ken, who was a formative figure in the UAW and plays a huge role in your book, of course, he received a savage beating.
When Ken returned from World War II, he was elected by acclamation to a very high local union office. He had no enemies. And Ken was the kind of guy, about my size, he was not a muscle man in the union, was known as a peacemaker, if anything. He was the guy who could negotiate things, work problems out. Within a month after his return, he was beaten to within an inch of his life, fractured skull in a couple of places, broken arm, broken leg, back problems, injuries, all, it was amazing he survived.
And this is where the gangster part of the story comes in, right?
Exactly.
This is underworld mafia figures hired by the company to go beat him within an inch of his life.
Well, you know, the company, and there was a corrupt UAW official here, too, all got together and said the leader of Local 212 was a guy, the Briggs local, was a fellow named Emil Mazie. Emil would eventually, with Walter Reuther, be the top leaders of the UAW. And there were some people who were out to get Emil, and Briggs didn't want a strong, militant labor leader that they had to deal with. The funny part, though, when Briggs was organized in 1937, Emil Mazie sent pamphlets out to everybody saying, we have a contract. That contract means we have to cooperate with the company. So the labor guys felt that if they would cooperate and try to make sure their members would cooperate, but they expected the same in return.
And no more wildcat strikes, basically, was what cooperating with the company meant,
That's right. And there was a problem. Sometimes these guys would strike. Briggs, it's important to mention, Briggs was a huge company. The main factory on the east side of Detroit on Mack Avenue stretched about a half a mile in length, employed upwards of 30,000 people. And so it was a very difficult place. Pete Waldmeier told me he worked there when he was a kid. And this is in the 50s. He said, I don't know how anybody could manage that place. So it's a very difficult place to manage, and there were a lot of wildcat strikes.
Bobby, you know, one of the things interesting to me, I mean, this town, this is a real 21st century town. Of course, now we're into the 21st century, and that's going to write a whole new chapter of manufacturing history. It's gone so global now, but the early half of the 20th century in Detroit is the incubator of American manufacturing as we know it today. I mean, Henry Ford, the Chrysler brothers, this extraordinary assembly line manufacturer that started up here in the early part of the 20th century is about this huge immigration into this town. The $5 a day work. You go from the production of a few hundred cars a year to millions of cars a year. I mean, just this incredible boom town. It's a labor mecca. People are coming here from everywhere. They can't believe that they're getting paid $5 a day. Your book, and talking about the beginning of the labor movement post-war, really pre-war and in the mid-30s.
Depends which war you're talking about,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's right. Pre-war and then on into the 1950s, that labor attitude changes. So what is happening there in the middle part of the century that now is creating this adversarial relationship between labor and management that really hasn't gone away today?
Well, you know, I look at it a little bit differently. And I think when unions were legalized, with the Wagner Act, with the Roosevelt administration, there was a lot of hope that there would be, in a sense, a little bit of about what the ideal was at the Tennessee plant with Volkswagen, that there'd be work groups, work committees, and there'd be a very progressive way of dealing with labor management issues. And in fact, unfortunately, what happened is the companies really were just so anti-union, everything became adversarial, much more so than I think it's just a sad story about what happened, because it didn't have to be that way. Mm-hmm. And one of the important points in with the labor leaders, and maybe that affected some things too. These labor leaders were incredibly young, incredibly smart. They would have succeeded at anything they wanted to do. In the chapter on World War II, I spent more time on it than maybe I should have, but it tells a story about my father, Ken, who really thrived during World War II in the Army Air Corps. And it demonstrated to him that he could do whatever he wanted to do. And what he wanted to do was come back to Detroit and try to build a strong labor movement.
You know, we talk about this adversarial relationship of capital versus labor, but I was very interested in reading how much internal warfare there was within the labor movement. I didn't know that there were two UAWs at one point,
yep.
One with the AFL, a different one with the CIO. As you mentioned, there was some pretty unsavory characters in the UAW as well. So that was a big eye-opener for me. It wasn't just labor versus the corporations. There were fights, deep fights, vicious fights, in fact,
deep
within
fights,
the union itself.
Deep fights, but also a lot of different men and some women, people who are ambitious, people who wanted to become president or move up within the union ranks. It's political. You get elected. So you have a whole, a lot of different dynamics are going on. But the other element, especially that I think highlighted the 30s and what I tried to get into, was it was Harry Bennett who tried to co-opt the first elected UAW president, Homer Martin, to essentially make the UAW a company union.
And Harry Bennett, of course, being
Henry Ford's right-hand
man. The goon, as it were, as he's been depicted in history for Henry
well,
Ford.
Harry Bennett was one of the most unique, one of the most powerful people who ever lived in the state of Michigan. And he ran the largest private army in the world, and he recruited from Jackson Prison. He was on the parole board, the state parole board. So, that was the people who the labor movement guys were dealing with. That was the people on the Battle of the Overpass.
Yeah.
Well, and one of the interesting stories that you tell in the book, it's a history, but it's a book full of really fascinating stories about very interesting characters, your father and Maisie and others. And there's a fascinating story, where Ford didn't want production at Briggs disrupted because it was where Ford got the bodies for its cars. And if I recall correctly, he sent Harry Bennett to meet the local leader, the UAW leader,
yep, at Dick Frankenstein.
Briggs. And he said, look, Mr. Ford does not want to support the union, but he wants this strike to go away. What do you need?
Mm-hmm.
And that, I thought that was fascinating and was not something that I expected.
Exactly. And I mean, it was very interesting. Henry Ford was opposed to unions without question, but number one, he wanted production. He didn't want any slowdown in production. He wanted his manufacturing lines to keep moving, to keep building cars. And that was the number one issue. And if anything affected production, he'd tell Harry Bennett, Harry, deal with this. And of course, Harry Bennett would do whatever his boss wanted by whatever means necessary.
Is that attitude, do you think, why when Ford Motor Company finally accepted the idea that the union's here to stay, that in many ways they went from having the worst imaginable relationship to a pretty good one with the union?
You know, actually, I talked when I did most of my research on this book down at Wayne State at the Reuther Archives, and Doug Fraser had an office there. And Doug's an old family friend, but we would talk a lot about this. And he said, you know, I asked him a kind of a similar question. And he said, it was amazing. We'd fight like hell to get a union. And then once we got a contract, we got pretty much whatever we wanted. You know, I mean, it was pretty, you know, interesting. And that, I think, also goes back to your point, you know.
Well, and what's, I mean, I come from a manufacturing family.
Sure.
From electronics manufacturing family. And I can tell you, there's no company founder who puts the capital and the risk into that company that wants a second management in his company. I mean, there's no executive I know that wants a union in his shop. But I think the experience of the UAW and those formative years have taught entrepreneurs how you treat labor properly. I mean, you come in and you create an environment from the ground up where the workers have a say from the get-go. Because the conditions you're talking that you describe in Briggs with the presses and whatnot, I mean, these were horrific conditions.
Yeah.
And at some point, it's not enough that these guys get paid a lot, because other industries come in and they match that. And unions, I think, had really improved working conditions to the point today now where it's hard for unions to get into new plants because management are so focused on keeping their workers happy because they don't want that second layer of management second-guessing them in the plant.
So what you're saying is that the strong unions build the model that other businesses copy to make sure they don't have a union. So without the union to be there in the first place, workers would be right back where they were in the 1930s.
Right, and even I make the analogy of the Civil Rights Movement, where the Civil Rights Movement in this country redefined what civil liberties were for everybody, for women on through minorities, and today. The civil rights movement in many ways has been bastardized because the civil rights movement has had to find other ways to maintain power. And you see, and with the modern union, with the UAW, I think it's almost unrecognizable from some of the readers, from some of the leaders that you describe in the mid-50s. I mean, you got Bob King in recent months trying to unionize the VW plant with card check. I mean, that's the most anti-democratic way. I mean, the secret ballot.
Well, that's certainly one interpretation of
right.
it,
yeah,
but it's not the only one.
We could
but
talk
card,
about
yeah,
Senator Corker, too.
But you see what I'm saying? Card check is inherently undemocratic. And here is Bob King working with management in the VW plant to try to get the union power.
Just one thing that I think is very important. UAW, I saw it with my father negotiating with a lot of different companies. 1979, Chrysler's about ready to go belly up. Yes, they got a government bailout, but without the UAW concessions, Chrysler would never have made it. The same is true. Look what Ron Gettelfinger did with General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler to make sure that we'd still have a domestic auto industry.
Well, we could debate all that, too, because the union didn't start to give concessions until those operations were bleeding red ink. They were losing billions in North America, and it was only then that the union gave them the concessions.
How much of that lays at the feet of the management teams that accepted the contracts that led to them to believe?
Well, this is a point that Bob raises in the book, too. Yeah. Hey, management agreed to all this. But I'd point out, too, it was the 97 or the 98 GM strike when they had negotiated a piecework contract. The workers were getting their work done in 2 to 3 hours and going home. And General Motors said, wait a minute. We need you guys to work 8 hours. And then we're like, no, we're out of here. And they said, well, if you guys walk off, we're going to pull the dies out of the plant. The union said, you pull the dies out of the plant, we're going on strike. $3 billion in losses later, General Motors went, we got to cave. Yeah. We've got to cave. So I don't entirely buy the argument that, oh, this was just management, you know, agreeing to this stuff.
It took both sides to do it. No question.
But John's right. I mean, it's the same in the airplane industry. I mean, you have so much capital flowing through these companies that work stoppages for public companies are crippling. So you want to come to agreement with the unions to prevent that from going. And that goes back to my original point, which is the good companies today do everything possible to keep a union to keep labor out because the work rules slow up production, but the threat of strike throws up production. And so it behooves any manufacturing industry today to do things right with their workers so they don't unionize.
Well, you know, and I know some of that, and I generally think there's always two sides to every story. But I do think that at the end of the day, look at where the labor is today and what they're doing in the plants, working with management. They know that if nothing else, they know that if the auto plants go away, they go away. So there's a mutual effort. And what is an auto plant today? It's such a different place than it was in the 30s and 40s.
Even the 70s, because I worked them in the 70s in Italia. Yeah, they're way better than that.
You need college, 2 years of college before you're even going to get
hired. Here's what I wonder, Bob, is I understand, to Henry's point, and agree with it, actually, why management does not want a union in there. Mm-hmm. What I don't understand, and maybe you can give us some insight here, why was Briggs so disrespectful of his workers? I mean, it's one thing to say we want, a flexible workforce. We want to keep our wages down or certainly our labor costs down. But, I mean, the way they treated the workers in that Briggs plant was totally unacceptable. Why? And Henry Ford was the same way. And I'm wondering, Briggs and Ford are kind of the same. Very little education. Briggs, quit school at 14, went to work. He started out as a common laborer.
Right.
Very bright guy, obviously. He didn't get to the top by accident. But do you have any insight? Why did these people disrespect and treat their workers so poorly?
Well, of course, the bottom line was one of the reasons. It was about money. Henry Ford, we talk about the $5 day wage, but not everybody. In fact, most people actually didn't get their $5 wage. And so, and there was a whole spying operation set up that if you lived in a certain way, boom, you'd get $2.75, not the $5. I mean, so that happened. What did Ford do when he went to the $5 wages? He sent his body manufacturing to Briggs, where they paid cheap wages. So, I mean, he's balancing everything out, as did Briggs. I mean, it's a sad story about Briggs because they were a very creative company. They built some of the first most unique, totally inline bodies that were made.
Enclosed bodies. Because in the early days, there was no roof to the car.
Exactly. They did it, and he found a way to do it cheaper. So it was a really neat story.
Just so some people don't know, because after reading your book, I had to go do some research of my own. Briggs was very pioneering. They bought the LeBaron Bodyworks Company. Yes. And all of us know the Chrysler LeBaron. Well, guess what? It was an old coachworks company. They did some of the original Woodies, with the wood on the outside of the car. They were very innovative, and they did a lot of styling before the car companies had their own internal styling department.
But then something happened in Briggs where they became so terrified of the unions. This goes back to 32, before the UAW. And they had a terrible strike in 32, but they, all of a sudden, the management shifted, and it shifted to going after the unions or any possibility of a union, and rather than on that creative side. And you could see it in the company, and you could see how after 32, the company really wasn't the same company because their focus wasn't on creativity. It was on how we're going to get these bastards from the UAW.
Yeah, and that is such a mistake. And again, look at the United States today. Where is all the employment in the auto industry? It's all in non-union shops. It's in the transplants have come here.
Well, not all.
But big word.
But half, certainly.
But you look at the growth in auto employment in the last couple of decades.
Terms is important.
Yeah, has all been non-union with the transplants, and it's been the union jobs that have been going away. And I'll give you a good and I think that's management, but I think unions are learning from that as well. And I'll give you a good example. There's a town outside of Indianapolis. I covered this story a couple of years ago. And there was a stamping plant, GM stamping plant, had to be closed during the restructuring. And J.D. Norman came in to take over the stamping plant. And they said, if we're going to keep this plant open, we're going to have to cut your wages in half to $16 an hour. And the union, because of the way the union had structured its national contract, the union voted to shut down that plant, eliminate 600 jobs. Which would be jobs for a new generation that destroyed a lot of local businesses. I mean, this was a union that basically destroyed a community so that the 600 workers at that plant would go on to more senior positions elsewhere in the country. And I think workers at VW and workers at Kia look at that and they say the unions are a barrier to employment.
How did the UAW, because the early days of it, the story is of communicating and explaining, you want me on your side, to the workers. Get me on your side and your life will be better, your job will be more secure. Has the union lost the ability to communicate that to people?
Well, yes and no. It was very interesting, and this is anecdotal, but when General Motors was going through bankruptcy, I several times listened to television interviews, and workers would say, my God, I have a union that's protecting me. Without the union, where would I be? And to your point about workers, the union jobs are gone. My understanding is through part of the negotiations that have gone on, union jobs are coming back from Mexico and other places. So it's not all black and white. I think in the South, there are some incredible cultural issues. You come to some dinners with my in-laws who are from the South, and we would have an interesting discussion because you mention UAW and they go nuts. They don't know why they're going nuts. You know, the salaries they're making are not very good. They don't have very good benefits, but boy, they just unions, that's just a foul word. And so there's a challenge that labor has to make sure people understand what's going on. And it's a hard challenge. And I don't know that I've got all the answers, except I do know that based on what history tells us, labor unions can be very good. You know, people talk about our declining middle class. We haven't had any middle class is basically where it was in 1973. Well, isn't it funny that as the middle class has declined, so has union membership? Well, maybe if union membership had been more stable, maybe our middle class would be better. Are our kids really going to be better off in the future? This may be the first generation where that gets turned around.
Well, one of the exciting developments I think that's happened in the state, and this is very much a part of the Southern culture that you talk about, is the advent of the right to work movement. And I think with the right to work movement, I mean, for a long time since I've been covering politics, before I joined this special class of auto reviewers, but in covering politics, the UAW had become a political arm of the Democratic Party and was feeding money to the Democratic Party, and there was a lot of members who felt alienated by that. And I think with the right to work movement, I think it's going to refocus unions on the worker. That we have to make sure that the workers
will,
are happy.
I don't think it will. Not in the case of the UAW. And the reason I say that is, the UAW is already in, I want to say, 6 or 7 right-to-work states,
yep.
2 of which have, just in the last few years, flipped to right-to-work.
Right.
and the union has lost a negligible number of members. And there's a very interesting thing here, that there's a true difference between blue-collar unions and white-collar unions. And the blue-collar people, brothers and sisters, stick with their union. The white-collar, not so much.
Well, I think there's another issue.
The white-collar bleed is...
I want to hear Bob about this, because we're getting down to the very end.
Yeah. Well, I think there's another issue, and it's really important, and especially for people at this table. What did we go through in the 60s, 70s, and even 80s? Poor production, poor quality. Well, when you've got workers who are maybe at odds with each other about dealing with collecting union dues, whatever the case might, joining the union, that is not good for the auto industry. And I think that's a potential problem. I think the big three, at least some people there, they've realized that, and they kind of, I think they kind of wish they took a little stronger role on that issue back a couple of years ago. The other thing I think that's really important, we talk about right to work. People, it sounds good. But, you know, what's not talked about is that, all right, you don't want to be a member of the union? Fine. Don't be a member. But yet, under federal law, if I'm a union and I negotiate a contract for my union members, the non-union members get all the same benefits. Is that fair? I don't think so.
And with that, we're going to have to wrap up. We got a whole nother show here that we're going to have to shoot. As you can tell, this book has sparked a whole bunch of debate right here at this table. I highly recommend it. I learned a ton. It's called Built in Detroit. Where can you get it?
You can get it on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com at any format. And it's at some bookstores in the Detroit area, but for sure you can get it there.
Bob, thanks so much. Same for Mark and Henry, too. And I want to thank all of you for having tuned in.